Welcome to a musical edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us. The accordion is so often lampooned in popular culture as uncool that it's easy to forget how the instrument was once as ubiquitous as the electric guitar. Philadelphia native Joe Satriani was part of this pre-rock and roll generation who grew up playing the squeeze box, eventually becoming a celebrated virtuoso. He joined me in the studio upon the release of a documentary about his life called Dizzy Fingers, The Life of Joe Satriani. Let's take a listen. I have to say, Joe Satriani, you play with a great deal of joy and passion. Was it always that way for you in the accordion?
Most of the time, but early on, it was work. And I think I have to thank my mother for keeping me at it. I wanted to go out and play ball with my buddies and friends. And so, no, I had to practice before I went out. In fact, I used to have a buddy of mine up the street. I'd be practicing in the second floor, and he'd throw pebbles up at the window. And he says, "When are you coming out to play?" I said, "I can't. I have another hour to practice."
And why did your mother want you to play the accordion?
Well, she just saw possibilities. I guess she saw more potential in me than I knew at the time. And it was through the help of my grandfather who helped us along our way as I was growing up.
And I'm assuming, there's a picture in the documentary, you know, you're a five-year-old boy with a tiny little accordion.
Yes, it was.
Right?
It was a 12-bass accordion, and that's what I started with.
Yeah. And was that a popular instrument? This is 75 years ago.
A long time ago. Yes, it was. I think everyone had an accordion in the closet. During the late 60s, when the Beatles came along, that kind of killed the accordion popularity.
The guitar sort of stole the thunder of the accordion?
Absolutely, yes, it did. And we're having such a difficult time getting it back to where it used to be. Everybody's saying, oh, the accordion is going through a renaissance. I see some of it only because of the internet, and
right.
It's loaded with accordion projects and websites. They're all over the place, especially the accordion world. It's one of the largest in the world, and you see hours and hours of accordion, and I'm just wondering if people are going to get tired of it.
No. Well, you have brought an accordion with you. It says Hohner?
Hohner Gola.
And this is, you were telling me before we went on the air, this is about, you bought it in the 60s, I guess.
Yes. And I was doing a function once, and a gentleman came up to me, and he says, "How old's that accordion?" I said, "Oh, it's got to be at least 10 years ago. It's got 40 years old." He says, "How come you never got a new one?" I says, "Did you ever hear anyone getting or trading in a Stradivarius?" And that stopped him in tracks.
But is that a Stradivarius in your mind?
Oh, yes. It just sings and speaks to me. Yeah.
Could you demonstrate something for us?
Sure.
Maybe just sort of what the keyboard sounds like.
Sure. I will play the one that I'm very happy with, and it did a lot for me, was the Mendelssohn Concerto. And this was the piece that I auditioned for the Philadelphia Orchestra. Now, you can imagine, Lorne Monroe, who happened to be the first cellist of the orchestra back in the 53, and Teresa Costello, I think that's what her name. She was a harpist. Now, I'm sitting down. She said, "What would you like to play?" I said, "The Mendelssohn Concerto, third movement." They looked at each other. Is this kid okay?
On an accordion,
is he serious? Yes. So this is what it was. The ending.
Wow. Bravo. Bravo.
I have to play the ending because it's almost a replica of what the violinist does.
Mm-hmm. what's great is you got the job. And I mean, you auditioned for Eugene Ormandy.
It was the first time in the history of the orchestra that an accordion had performed. And it might be interesting for your audience to know that on the same program was Anna Maffa.
Wow.
And she was just getting her start in the opera business, opera world.
Were you nervous?
Much so, yes. In fact, when I auditioned for Ormandy the second time, I didn't think I had a chance to win because I was up against Curtis students, vocal arts students, and here I am, accordion player, a talent, vocal, instrumental, and so forth. After I had performed, I was walking out of the building. I said, I don't have a chance. And the woman came back and got me. She says, where are you going? I said, there's too much talent. I don't belong here. This is not my niche, I don't think. She says, don't be so surprised. So she called me back, and sure enough, to make a long story short, I was selected as it was a senior student concert, and I played an accordion concerto that was unknown at the time, and I was only 18, so they came to me and said, what would you like to play? I had no idea. So they did some research and came up with the concerto in D minor, and the rest is history, as they say.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm curious about the kind of music that you like to play on the accordion.
I'm a classical guy.
Are you?
Yeah, from way back when, I always loved the classics. In fact, one of my ambitions early on was to play with a symphony orchestra, and I didn't know it was going to be the Philadelphia Orchestra. That was my dream. And there's a little story that the Bellevue Stratford had a concert trio for many years. It was violin, cello, and piano. And when the new management came in, they wanted to take the cello out and put an accordion in. Can you imagine?
Really?
So Lou Chaikin called me. God bless him. He was a great musician and did a lot of work in the city. He called me. He says, I want you to work with me at the Bellevue. I said, Lou, I don't know one tune. I said, I'm a classical accordion player. He said very facetiously, can you read? I said, yes, I can. He said, come on, you'll make it. Make a long story short, I was there one season, and I was able to play all the tunes, all the show tunes that he had put in front of me. Actually, didn't put in front of me. There was no music. He had been there 25 years before I came into the picture. I stayed 6 years, and gave me the list, or as he was playing, I had to write down the tune, the key, and I had a library at home, and I did research and came up with a book for Lou Chaikin. So, but that's I broke into that end of the business, and I got to like it. It was kind of a little side from what I was used to practicing 5 and 6 hours a day.
Did your mother, who wanted you to play the accordion, did she know how good you became?
I don't know.
I mean, because it sounds like at a young age, I mean, you're playing local radio and TV shows here in Philadelphia and got on the Arthur Godfrey show. You're what, 18 years old,
18,
something like that?
Yeah. I don't know. I just had the encouragement from my parents.
Right.
That was automatic. And my aunts and cousins and mother, and grandfather, and it was there. So I figured, you know, that love went to all of us. So I never, you know, thought I was being centered as the one with the ability to play an instrument. They all had an opportunity. My sister played. My cousins played.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
But so it was a kind of – and I assume people in the neighborhood, would you get together and jam?
Sometimes, yes. Yeah, yeah. I was always asked to play church affairs and different accordion clubs and so forth throughout the year.
You taught for how many – in the Philadelphia public school system for –
Well, I started at the New Power Conservatory, which was a very, very fine accordion conservatory, and I became the assistant director of that school until the 60s. And we had a great staff, and everybody was going out to different pastures, and I remained because my love for the accordion was so great. I saw the demise of our instrument, I stayed with it till the end. And after a point, I couldn't make a living with that. So I ended up getting a teacher's degree in Philadelphia, and I spent 20 years at Lamberton High School, and I had some great students, and they have great stories to tell.
You enjoy teaching?
I love it. I love it, yes.
And just because kids are sort of hungry to learn and you get to show them how to play an instrument?
Yeah, I would show them the way. In fact, I'd get a lot of calls. I had a call from a student of years back, and they thanked me for getting him into teaching. And one gentleman said, I'm making a lot of money teaching.
Oh. You know,
that was then with the EC programs, and he's doing well as a young man. And I was so glad to hear that. I have many students out there.
You mentioned the fact that you had such a supportive family. It sounds like a very musical family as well. Did you have a teacher or certain teachers that you felt really showed you the way?
I had teachers from the very beginning, elementary school.
In school?
In school, at public school. And they always saw potential in me, which I didn't see at the time. And I would play the accordion in the orchestra. Now, usually today they would say, hey, you have to play a trombone or you have to play a saxophone. What, an accordion?
Yeah.
They never took that away from me. And I guess subconsciously I read something into that, said, I have to stay with this. I went to junior high school, and I met up with a piano player, and we did piano duos together. And that's where I learned to use accordion with piano accompaniment. And I still use that today.
And we close out my interview with accordionist Joe Soprani with his rendition of the popular musical standard, Anime Corps. You're listening to a very special musical edition of Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear my conversation with guitarist Behdad Mogadasi. Stay with us. Welcome back to our all-music edition of Radio Times in Review. Behdad Mogadasi is a Tehran-born guitarist whose solo acoustic music draws on many traditions. These include flamenco, Azerbaijani folk music, and American classic rock. He joined me in the studio several years ago and brought along his guitar to help explain his unique approach to incorporating disparate playing styles. Before we get to my conversation, let's listen to his piece Allegro Animato from his Persian Suite from 2010.
Thank you.
It's Bogdan Megadasy, our guest today on Radio Times, performing Allegro Animato from his composition Persian Suite. It also happens to be the title of his new CD. It's a great pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. This is a suite that you spent about 5 years working on?
Yes. I had this idea to compose this piece, but for me, the issue was to finding the tuning. The tuning is when you play the guitar, mostly you are in a Western style of major and minor tonality. But in Iran, you have different systems. So finding the tuning was a very big challenge for me. Well, finally, I found it. And then after I found it, I knew that I can develop some of my idea in this system, which is kind of chahargah, one of those Iranian modes.
Well, does that mean that you tune your guitar differently from the way an American or Western-born guitarist would tune their guitar?
Yes. I tune differently. But nowadays, in the modern guitar, there are a lot of people that they tune their guitar differently. I think mine is personal and mine, it's not copying anyone else. So it's a little bit personal tuning, I can say.
Could you hit the strings for us?
Oh, this tuning that I have now, it's a Western.
It's a Western tuning.
Western tuning. That one is different a little bit. And if I change the tuning, now it's going to lose
yes,
the tuning.
It will.
It's
I know.
It's very tricky.
It is.
Playing the guitar, it's tuning the guitar is a little tricky. We have to stay, let the guitar stay on the environment to keep. So I cannot tune that way
I certainly understand that. And one can hear that in the music. And there has, at least in my Western ears, a kind of major-minor sound to it.
Exactly.
I mean, we're used to putting things into minor key or major key.
Exactly.
But I hear that blend when I hear your music.
Yes. Issues in playing guitar in Persian music is the semitone, the notes that are smaller than step, a half step. So how we are going to do that? So, and also because of those notes, for example, a Western scale has 12 notes.
That's right.
A Persian scale has 17 notes. It makes it a little bit difficult to make some harmony for that. So the challenge would be how we find tuning that allows you to do the harmony for your music. That was one of the issues.
You grew up in Iran, in fact, in several parts of Iran. Where were you born?
I was born in Tehran. My father was working for government, so we had to travel different places. I grew up in Balochistan. You know, when you go to Iran, it's interesting. It's beautiful. Different environments. You go to Sahara, you go to jungle, green places, hot places, cold areas. And I grew up when I was a child in Balochistan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a Sunni area close to Pakistan with their own specific culture, clothing, language is totally different. So I grew up there. And then for years I was there. Then when I was 9, 10 years old, we went to Kurdistan, which is totally different place in the other part of the country, more green. And again, different language, but this is also the Sunni part of the country. So we were Shia, so it was interesting for us to be in a region with different religion that we had, but they were very nice. But
it does tell you about the diversity of of the culture, of the art, and I'm sure of the music as well.
Yes. One of the interesting things that I found out is that for thousands of years, these people, us, we lived with our differences peacefully for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And you learn a lot when you go to different places, their food, their ceremonies, their language. So when you go to Azerbaijan, for example, or you go to Arab parts of the Iran in southwest, you will mm-hmm. feel that you are, but they're living for thousands of years together.
So what kind of music did you grow up then hearing, listening to?
Listening to music was kind of one part of our family tradition. Always we used to sing, or we used to dance, and we were listening all kind of music. My parents, they liked the ethnic music, like Azerbaijani music.
The more kind of folk music, we
folk
might call
music,
it.
Folk music, yes, that's right. And then, but when I grew up, little by little, I was listening to the 70s rock music. That was the point that starts me to come through the music.
And that was your introduction to guitar as well? Is that when you began to think, gosh, I'd like to be a guitar player?
Yes,
guitar.
Yes. It's just everyone. You know, when you see these people, we couldn't see them, but you listen to them, like these bands, Deep Purple, Genesis. For a long time, I was thinking that Jose Feliciano is the best guitarist in the whole world.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know?
Well, he had a big fan base here, too.
Yes, but that was little by little. And at that time, I was in Balochistan, not in Tehran. And it's interesting. In that area, you listen to the rock music of 70s, beautiful rock music of 70s and 80s. Yeah.
Well, so it's interesting. You've got these folk traditions that you grew up with, and you've got the rock and roll of the 1970s. But here you are, a classical guitarist.
Yes. For years, I taught myself I wanted to be a rock star, but then I found out that with the guitar that I have, and there was no school of teaching. School means method of teaching. So one day I listened to a piece by Bach with the guitar, and the point was I thought that there are two guitars that they are playing that piece, and it took me a long time to copy that because I could not read and write. And after a while I found out, oh my God, this is one guitar playing two music at the same time. And then I was amazed. Then I found a teacher, a good teacher, which is my friend now. And I was searching for learning years and years and years.
Do you remember what Bach piece you heard?
Yes. It was this piece. So I was listening, let's say, I was listening to something like this. A bass guitar plays this. I heard at the same time, and then so at that moment I was amazed how they can do that, because you don't see this kind of stuff on electric guitar.
You know, I have to say, and we've been listening to your music over the last couple of days, is your sound is so clean and so melodic. And I don't know, I mean, I have to say I'm very struck by it. And I also notice, and I've listened to other solo classical guitarists play, and you can usually hear them breathing. I don't hear you breathing on your CD.
Yes, that's an issue. Actually, I wanted to be natural. So at the end of some of pieces, you can hear me breathe. But playing clean, it's one of the art of the engineering of recording. It's not just the musician. Mm. It's the engineer also. Alfred Goodrich in Ardmore, he's fantastic. So he was very good on how to record, how to avoid that, with a lot of microphone around me.
Sure.
And you don't hear those stuff. So he was taking care of that. But there are some which we agreed to put some breathing, let it breathe. But I was careful also to not to make too much noises. But the melodies that you said, one of the issues in Persian music or in Eastern music is the melody. Because the music is monophone. So when you are composing something Western, if you find a melody, you can play with that melody. You can spread it to the different instruments or different parts. But when you are in East, you have just one voice, one sound, and the melody is very important. You have to find beautiful, nice melodies and develop them. That was another issue to compose.
I'm so interested, too, in the differences between the East and the West approach to if not just music, but also the guitar, in terms of rhythms and the kind of syncopation that I certainly heard in a lot of your playing, and playing with these kinds of notes that are I think unusual to Western ears.
Yes, yes. The guitar is a very interesting instrument. Actually, in Iran, it's a huge society. There are very, very good guitar players in Iran. And sometimes I saw on the internet, they say, okay, if you are looking for a flamenco style, Tehran is one of those centers.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I believe that. They're very good guitar players. And let me tell you something. When we were at the university, when we were studying about the steel strings instruments, fretted instruments, then you go to thousands of years ago and you see, okay, there was this instrument in Iran called tar or sitar or instrument like that. And then little by little, after the invention of Islam in Iran, and then it goes by Iranian musician like Zalzal and people like it goes to Arab countries, Islamic countries, and through that part it goes to Spain, this kind of instrument and this music. Now you can feel similarities between flamenco music and some part of the Persian folk music. And you can feel that. Now, I think guitar is going to be the next big instrument Iran. In Iran, because this instrument has the ability to explain Iranian young, new generation of musicians that they live in the country.
Well, you know what? I'd love to, since you brought your guitar, and I know you have a new composition, I'd love to have you play it for us.
This is a new piece. I didn't finish it yet. I played just the introduction. It's on Chargah again, mode, Persian mode. It has two movements. I play just the beginning introduction, and then I'll talk about the difference between Eastern and Western music.
Sure. Up in Iran in part after the Iranian Revolution of
yes.
1979. Did that change music or change how music was appreciated or understood
oh, yes.
at the time?
Oh, yes, yes. Revolution everywhere have effect on everything. It's not just in music, in literature, in poetry, and it has effect on music. One part of the thing that happened in Iran, the government didn't ban or stop classical music. So you see some development growth of classical music, not pop music, which was not good.
Exactly.
So for the classical music or traditional music, they were okay to play. And then you see, because of the revolution, because of the economy, because of the war, you didn't have anything to do, there was nothing to do. So you see, then this is the best entertainment that you can do. So thousands of kids, they go to learn instruments, music, and they practice hard. And you can see a lot of concerts, private concerts. Actually, for 10, 15 years maybe, most of our concerts was privately.
In someone's house, perhaps?
Someone's house or at cultural societies. There are institutes in Iran. And little by little, they opened up. And that was the time that I performed with Tehran Symphony Orchestra. But revolution, 100%, had effect. And also, after the revolution, 6, 7 years after the revolution, for the first time, they opened the music university. There were some controversy issues about that. Do they have to open or not? And at the university, there were a lot of discussion about the traditional music.
Hmm.
In internal dialogue between Iranian musicians about which way we have to go and what's the difference between the dialogue. So I think it had the revolution itself had a good effect on music.
And we close out my interview with Iranian guitarist Behdad Mokhdasi with his piece entitled Love, part of his 2010 trilogy for guitar. You're listening to a musical edition of Radio Times in Review. When we get back, we'll hear from composer and instrument maker Dan Truman. Stay with us. Welcome back to the music edition of Radio Times in Review. You're hearing a snippet of a piece entitled Another Wallflower, composed by Princeton professor of music Dan Truman. If the instrumentation sounds unorthodox, it's because Truman wields a unique approach to music, which involves electronics, homemade electroacoustic instruments, avant-garde recording methods, and a modified Norwegian fiddle. He joined me in the studio a couple of years ago upon the release of his album Neither Anvil Nor Pulley, which employed the New York City ensemble So Percussion. Let's listen. Describe your Norwegian Hardanger fiddle, which you have right in front of you there.
Yeah, this is an elaborately decorated instrument, as you can see. And it, you know, people ask me a lot, what's the difference between a fiddle and a violin? And,
yes.
And in this case, it's really quite different. It's tuned up quite high, which, you know, if you play violin, you'll recognize that. But especially underneath, it's got these extra strings, sympathetic strings that ring along.
So four on top?
Four on top. And then five underneath. And those ones underneath, we call them understrings, and they sing along as we play. So that's sort of the magic component of the instrument.
And is that what attracted you to this instrument, this kind of fiddle?
That combined with the music that's traditionally played with it. When I first heard it, it had one of those musical experiences that I think most musicians have at some point where you just can't believe what you're hearing and you need to find out more. And certainly the sympathetic strings played a big part in that sound that kind of grabbed me.
And where were you when you first heard it?
I remember exactly where I was. I was, you know, sitting on a couch in my room in Cincinnati at the time, and somebody gave me a cassette tape of some of this music from the 50s, actually. I just fell in love with it.
And and because of the mix of sounds, the fact that it has this sort of higher sound to it?
It's got a higher sound. It's got this warm ringing sound. And also, one of the things I didn't mention is it has a flat bridge. Now, so violins normally have a pretty curved bridge so that all the strings are individually accessible. On this instrument, the bridge is almost flat, so it's really hard to play individual strings. So most of the time, you're playing two or three strings at a time. So it's got this big, rich sound with lots of melodies happening simultaneously. So that also kind of really drew me.
Well, I'm looking at it, and I'm sorry to say to our listeners, I'm sorry you can't see it, although we have posted some photos on our Facebook page. Yeah. It's very elaborately decorated, lots of inlay.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, thank you. I love it.
And carved at the top, there's even a little head at the very top.
There's a dragon head at the top of this one. That's right. It does look a bit like a Viking ship.
Yes. And do you electrify this? Do you need to electrify it? Is that something you have done to the Hardanger fiddle?
It's fairly common to put a microphone on it. So it's used primarily actually for dancing.
Oh.
And when you play for dancing, traditionally you'd sit in the middle of the room and they would dance around you. Of course, these days, we tend to sit off on the side, and they put a mic on the fiddle, and they actually put a mic on our feet so that you can be really big for the dancers to hear you. That's about it in terms of electrifying it for me. It's mostly just the good old-fashioned sound of the instrument. You bow it, that's right, yeah.
But I'm interested in you as a instrument maker, which mm-hmm. you are, but not, I guess, in the sort of traditional sense. I mean, it seems like you're interested in sound.
Yeah, that's right. And some of that comes from the Hardanger fiddle that we were talking about earlier. When I started playing this instrument, I just was so struck by how these slight differences in design totally changed the kind of music that I could make, the kind of music it inspired. And so that sort of become a model for me in terms of building new instruments. Now, it's true, I don't most of the time sit down with wood and saws and stuff like that. I've done some of that in the past. I'm not very good at it, and I've suffered various wounds from that sort of thing. So I sort of retreat to the safety of software instruments for the most part. And in that case, again, I'm trying to make things that inspire us physically, actually, to make music, to play with sound. And 99% of the things that I try are just not very interesting. Right. So I'll spend, a minute with it and go, it's the cases where I'll build something. 3 days later, I'll sort of wake up and realize I've just been playing with it constantly. And that to me, this is a good sign. This means there's something going on here. There's something that's engaging about this. So I'm sort of always searching for that.
So what does your studio look like?
It's a lovely little attic studio. Mm-hmm. I have my fiddles hanging on one wall and then my computer and little speakers on another wall. And lots of room to play, basically. I like to make music with people, and so I have sort of space to play with other fiddlers and musicians who come by.
But you always have to be so careful when you're talking about music and new music and stretching boundaries and categories. I mean, are you trying to sort of get out of some of the way that we segregate sounds and, classical music and jazz and folk?
Right, yeah. I don't think I'm consciously trying to do anything like that. The question about my studio is interesting in the sense that I have the fiddles hanging there, I've got the computer there, and I go back and forth between them all the time. And whenever I'm making new music, I basically just see it all at my disposal, and I'll use whatever seems to be right at that time. And the result is now that my studio is this hodgepodge of things that ends up in the music, because that's sort of what I do as a musician.
It's obviously as the composer, the musician, it has to feel right to you.
Yeah, that's true. And again, I think the question of how lost I get in it.
Yeah.
So if I feel like, as a fiddler, I sit and I play tunes and I get lost in the world of these tunes. In the fiddle world, they talk about playing yourself away. So if you're playing for dancing, for instance, you'll play and basically you almost lose consciousness. And time will go by, and then later you realize you have no idea what happened.
Yeah. That's a wonderful place to be, isn't
it?
It's
fantastic, yeah. I'm always frustrated if I'm making something new, a new piece or a new instrument, that somehow inhibits that, gets in the way or feels, like it doesn't provide a way to get to some place that I can't get to otherwise.
I want to play another piece. The CD is called Crisscross, and this is a song called Crisscross. Mm-hmm. This is very different from what we heard from your new CD.
Yeah, right. So this is a collaboration with Brittany Haas, who is a fantastic young fiddler who was actually an undergraduate at Princeton. And she and I worked together on a whole bunch of tunes. And it in some ways comes from a similar place in that she plays a five-string fiddle, and it's tuned up totally differently than my hard-on fiddle here. So part of our problem was, how do we play together? So the whole mission was to make tunes together that we could play together. And so this first track is one of those tunes. She actually made the tune, and then I made this big arrangement for it that we put together. So.
And it also includes Natalie Haas on cello. Is that a sister?
That's her older sister. Fabulous cellist, yeah.
Jordan Tice, guitar, Corey DeMario, bass, and Dan Truman playing
Hardanger fiddle. Yeah.
Hardanger fiddle. Let's listen. again, a song called Crisscross from a 2012 CD called Crisscross as well. I really like that. I mean, you I were sort of rocking to those rhythms. Now, that those high notes, is that you?
That's me, yeah. I'm playing these, what they call artificial harmonics on the Hardanger fiddle there, yeah.
And the bass line is it's such a nice sort of counterpoint to those high notes.
Yeah, oh, good. I'm glad you think so. That's, I mean, that I love the bass line. That comes actually, funny, from all the stuff I've done with Bach, actually, over the years, studying Bach and counterpoint. I teach counterpoint a lot. And so the bass line in a lot of this music really comes from that, as opposed to a lot of how we're taught to do bass lines with chords. This is more about a line, a bass line that has its own trajectory. So it sometimes goes in funny places.
Who else is, I mean, has Bach been an influence on you?
Oh, big time, yeah. I mean, I grew up playing that. In terms of my classical training as a violinist, that's really the music that stayed with me since I've become transformed into a fiddler.
Yes.
The one thing that remains is the Bach. And at Princeton, I teach Bach-style counterpoint.
Oh, wow.
So it's part of my daily life.
Well, and I've always thought there's a part of Bach that is so sort of mathematical in a way.
Mm-hmm. Very precise and architectural and really highly crafted, and if you pull one little note out of the wrong place, the whole thing will fall down. So
were you a child prodigy? I know you play violin.
No.
Were you a gifted
I was
player?
Reasonably gifted, but not anywhere near a child prodigy. I was very interested young, begging my parents when I was 2.5 and 3. But play violin, yeah. But, you know, I had definitely encountered limits. I was not a prodigy. I was not going to be a professional classical violinist, and I don't think I ever really wanted to be. You know, I discovered recently that what I really wanted from when I was 2.5 was to be a fiddler. But where I grew up, there weren't really any fiddlers around.
Long
Island,
so right?
Exactly, there wasn't that at my disposal. And so, I think it makes sense that you're not necessarily as good at things that you, in your heart, aren't really wanting to do.
So, were you in school bands? Did you have a band?
Growing up a little bit, but you know, I was pretty much a classical violin geek growing up. And when I was in college, I started playing in bands a little bit, and then started playing jazz. And I had the 6-string electric violin that I played, and it wasn't until sort of the midst of that struggle to find the music that I wanted to play with this instrument that I discovered the Hardanger fiddle, and I was primed for it, and I just fell for it.
So is a violin sort of like ballet and a fiddle is like modern dance? I mean, is that how those instruments might be different from each other?
Well, no, I think they both have really old traditions. Mainly, I think the biggest difference has to do with how people learn that music. In classical violin, you learn it through reading notation. With fiddle music, you learn it all by ear. And so with fiddle music, you know, the constraints of your memory become a major issue. The way things change as they're passed on by ear becomes very important.
Did you have to unlearn things to be a fiddle player?
I did, yeah. And in fact, this Hardanger fiddle, this Norwegian fiddle, helped me with that because it was smaller and it felt different enough that it forced my years of training, you know, in my bow arm and my fingers to accommodate and try to find something else.
Mm-hmm. Relax?
To relax, that's right, because classical violin, you're constantly trying to project over an orchestra, be really loud, lots of power. With the Hardanger fiddle in particular, it's actually much more graceful. It's much more about sort of pulling out a ringing sound from the instrument. So it's not as powerful. It's more gentle.
You mentioned Bach as an influence. Yeah. Who else has been an influence on you as a composer, musician?
Yeah, so this fiddle music from Norway in particular, and it's hard to identify composers. They don't even call themselves composers. They don't talk about composing. They talk about making tunes, right? You know, and that music and that sort of that culture of making and sharing tunes has been enormously influential, both in terms of the details of the kinds of notes and rhythms that I like to put together, but also in terms of the process of making music with other people. And really trying to collaborate, trusting your ears, and trying to sort of create a community in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that for sure. I mean, another, of course, Stravinsky. I mean, I spent a lot of time with Stravinsky, you know.
Love Stravinsky.
Yeah, and Morton Feldman is another composer who, you know, he's got this incredible quality with these very quiet sonorities, which we're not hearing here very much, but it's something that's part of what I do and what I'm drawn to in a way. Current composers, there's so much wonderful composing going on out there now, including, you know, people like my colleagues Steve Mackey and Paul Lansky, people who have really, you know, influenced the way I think about music and write music.
I read that you majored in physics. Is that true?
I did, yeah.
What was that about?
What was that about exactly? My dad is a theoretical physicist.
Oh,
and so I grew up in a scientific family, and I was very drawn to it. I was drawn to the sort of abstract analytical qualities of it, and I sort of felt like, well, if I can study physics, I can do anything. Which is, of course, not true. But it felt, you know, there is some truth to it in the sense that there's a sort of general quality to this type of study, and so yeah, I did that. I thought I was going to pursue it, but then I remembered the moment I threw my applications in the trash for graduate school is when I realized I was going to have to quit playing fiddle.
Oh, you couldn't do both?
Well, you know, you probably could. But at the time, I had a friend who was at MIT in graduate school. He said, well, you're not going to be able to play when you're in graduate school in physics. And it's true, you wouldn't be able to play much, and certainly not the way that I did. I mean, at that point, when I would have been in graduate school in physics, that was when I sort of set off on this adventure, sort of economically treacherous adventure of trying to, you know, become a musician. And that's when I found all of these things that have really made me a musician today.
And we close out my conversation with composer, musician, and Princeton professor Dan Truman with a cut from his forthcoming album, Nostalgic Synchronic, Etudes for Prepared Digital Piano. And that wraps up this edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.